and Ed are now up with item 7.
Oh, it's you guys.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome.
It is all yours.
Great.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. I hope your summer is going well. Already into late July. It's hard to believe. So before we get started, we have a separate presentation for you here titled The Current Assessment Review for Contra Costa County. And I do want to get into that, but first, just to put this in proper context, you know, this is sort of the next step as we come on board and get to know you, and as we lead up to the investment strategy development workshop that we're targeting for, I think, late September, trying to nail down those dates. But this is sort of that next step. So the current assessment of the plan overall and where we stand. So if you've had a chance to look through it, there's some good materials that I want to talk to. And if you turn behind page 1 to page 2, we have the table of contents, which typically is both a table of contents and sort of the agenda for how we're going to walk through it. Today's a little different, though, because what I'd like to do is hold the investment policy discussion till last. And therefore, I'd like to start in first with the liabilities and then work through the other pieces of the components, because I think the investment policy discussion is going to be more of a discussion, more so than the other pieces where we're more or less presenting the facts, and you'll see how that works. So let's do that. Let's turn to page 10 then for the liabilities, and one page after that, page 11. We have a chart here and a couple bullet points highlighting the status of the plan, and as you know, it's not 100% funded. In fact, what we show here in 2014 is about 86%. That's probably a little bit higher today. So, you know, close to 90% funded status. And because of that, it's interesting to see how when you have an assumed rate of return of 7.25%, the years when you outperform that are good. We want to have years where we outperform it. But it doesn't really make progress because the liabilities are also growing. And so you actually have to outperform your assumed rate to make progress on your funded status. Does that make sense? Yeah. So you kind of see that in the table. And the first two bullet points up above really kind of nail that. So the market value of the assets over a 3- and 10-year period have been growing at 11% for 3 years and 6.2% for 10 years. And this is actual account balance. There's nothing, no special math behind those calculations. The liability side over those same periods have grown at 5.4% and 6.1%. So you see that over the 10-year period, assets growing at 6.2, liabilities growing at 6.1, even though we've had some terrific performance, even though we think of the plan as being number one on a 10-year basis, on a universe peer ranking basis, it's still just holding steady, really, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we're kind of at that same position with the growth rate. So we have to think about that, right? That's something we want to consider, and it's very, very clear that as we're trying to meet the obligations of the plan, the obligations are the liabilities, we need to think about how we meet those growing liabilities. So the next page then, page 12, takes another little deeper look into the cash flows. And we know that the cash flows come in from employer and employee contributions, and we have to pay the benefit payments and expenses. And so we chart that all out, and we see that the contributions are growing at a 4.9% annual rate, but that's not keeping up with benefit payments, which are growing at 6.5%. So this has a lot to do with participants retiring, how the retiree payrolls look, how the growth of those benefit payments profile out. And you think about the adjustments that have been made to different accumulation rates and the tiering and the crediting, but that's not going to take real effect on the cash flows of the plan for decades. You know, that takes a long time for those to flow through. So we're in this situation now where we have the cash flows coming in on a negative basis, really. And that's operating. So then what we do next is we say, well, okay, we have an investment portfolio here. We expect to get yield and return from that. How does that help us? And that's a big component of why we have positive cash flows. And that's shown in the right-hand side. So if you take a look at that orange line on the left side and the right side, you can see that that is what shifts from the negative position to a positive position because we're taking into account interest, dividends, and real estate income, which has been a really strong source. Now, we think about that in a going forward environment. If rates are low, we're in a low interest rate environment, what's our ability to generate investment returns from those income streams going forward? So some thoughts and considerations for the future we'll want to deal with. And then page 13 takes a look at the participant statistics themselves. And here we're showing that in aggregate, total participant count has increased at 1.8% annual rate. So that takes into account retirees, actives, and inactives. But you can see in the chart in the lower left-hand side that the growth has really been across the retirees and somewhat with the inactives. The actives have basically stayed flat over this time period. And so again, we're looking at how are contributions coming into the plan and who's pulling money out of the plan. If you take a look at the payrolls and everything, we have the active participants being the contributors into the plan. The retirees is the growing number, and that's what's coming out. And again, you would expect this at some point to plateau and to come back down, knowing that the total participant rate is relatively flat. Eventually, this will change, but for now, we're seeing that increase in the payrolls. So we have a liability situation, right? We know now, when you think about the cash flows, when you think about the participant counts, and when you think about the liabilities overall, we have a challenge ahead of us. But it's not a bad situation. It's manageable, we think. So let's turn to the page then and get into the asset allocation a little bit. And how are we trying to meet these needs with our portfolio? And so here we have the asset allocation lined up on page 15. And this is basically a review of the asset allocation in terms of what do we think about it with our capital market assumptions, which come out every year, taking those current capital market assumptions and working them through the current asset allocation. And there are a couple key takeaways from this. One is that in the upper right-hand corner, you see the forecast 10-year return. Current 6.3, policy 6.4, basically the same number, a little bit north of 6%. And you think about that and you say, well, okay, 6 and change is less than 7 and change. And if we're targeting 7.25% as our actuarial assumed rate, how do we get there? Well, there are a couple notes down below that help explain that. One is that the actuarial assumption to get to 7.25 uses an inflation estimate of 3.25. We have a different perspective on inflation, possibly due to a different time horizon. We look at a 10-year horizon. Your actuary typically looks longer. And our number is 2.1. So if you think about that difference, 2.1 versus 3.25, that helps explain a part of it. And if you think about that, then, you know, on a real return basis, we're a whole lot closer. So that accounts for at least one percentage point. The other part is, on the left-hand side, our capital markets assumptions for real estate are 5.1%. It is near the bottom, probably the bottom third, and it's the third column from the left, CMA's 10-year. There's a 5.1, and that's for core. But your actual portfolio is also invested in value-add and opportunistic, which you would expect to have both higher risk and higher return components to it. So when you take that all into consideration, the current portfolio is probably pretty well positioned to meet the 7.25%, maybe even higher. We might even think of it as being 7.5 or 7.6, something in that neighborhood, which can then lead to discussion, are we taking on too much investment risk? Should we be gearing that down? Thinking in about the liabilities, should we be taking on extra investment risk, seeking extra investment return so that we close our funding gap? So these are some of the discussions. These are the kinds of things we'll want to be thinking about with the investment strategy development workshop. What are the trade-offs? What's the right thing to do? So this is just
a quick question, Ed, on your table, the upper right-hand corner, the forecast 10-year return, you have current and then you have policy at 6.4. What's the 6.4?
So the policy is your stated investment policy targets in your investment policy statement. The current is where the assets are currently allocated. So there are some modest overweights, underweights to that.
Yeah, I noted the underweights on the...
Yes, exactly.
The other allocation.
Right. Yeah. And then on page 16, these are some charts that you've seen before, some tables that were showing the risk contribution and the asset class diversification across the plan. So nothing particularly noteworthy here. You've seen these before. We're looking at a risk metric when we consider the standard deviation of the portfolio at about 11.5%. And then we have the asset allocation diversification. Page 17 shows how that risk is diversified across the asset classes, noting that it's mainly in the equity side, domestic and international equity. And then we have some with private equity as well and some with real estate. Those are the key drivers of the risk. So no surprise, those are the risk exposures that have purposefully been taken in the past. Page 19 then starts looking at the risk. Again, similar to the risk dashboard that we've used in the past with you. Showing that the risk contribution by risk factor, again, heavy equity. Next highest is actually currency exposure, but much, much lower extent. And then credit and rates. So we're really taking a lot of the equity exposure. And then how does that work out in stress tests? And pages 20 and 21 highlight that, also similar to what you've seen in the risk dashboard, that if we look at specific drivers of economic returns, if we said U.S. dollar appreciates 20% or global equity markets appreciate 20%, what's going to happen to the portfolio? And this is the profile. Similarly, on page 21, if history were to repeat itself, my youngest child said if history repeats itself, he wants a dinosaur. So we'll see if that happens. But if history repeats itself, here's what would happen to the portfolio. So interesting. It's interesting because these are real-life situations as opposed to just hypotheticals. And then pages 23 through the end up until the appendix are recaps of the investment managers themselves. I don't want to go through each one of these strategies, but I think these are very handy. In fact, these might be handy for you as committee members, being that you come to the meetings on a monthly basis and quarterly report performance reviews, have something within quick grasp to say, what are we investing in here and why, and what, how's the strategy? So those are some of the bare bones facts. I'd like to jump to the investment policy statement part now, and that would be turning back to pages 6. Open up to 6 and 7 here. So pages 6 and 7 take a look at investment policy in a traditional asset class approach versus a risk factor approach. And we present this to you here because it was one of the things we were asked to do as an exercise when you were interviewing us. And so we wanted to just, you know, revisit this and think about it again. It's not necessarily something we're advocating. It's, again, something we can consider for the investment strategy development workshop. But basically it's saying that when we take a look at a risk-based investment policy, it's going to have a different approach to its construction versus the traditional. And so page 6 basically takes you through those blocks where we have the traditional investment policy where we are today, risk-aware and risk-based. So this is something we talked about in our interviews with a number of you in terms of understanding risk approaches. It is something that can be incorporated on a very customized basis. We can think about what's appropriate for Contra Costa and pick out pieces and integrate those. And it's also evolutionary because the risk approach to investing is still relatively new. And so a lot of the thought leaders in that arena continue to evolve and develop. And the investment policy statement is a living document. It should be treated as a living document, and so it should be updated appropriately. So these are a couple of things for consideration. And page 7 gets into more specifics about how the current investment policy statement is outlined and where risk can be integrated.
Ed, question, is it fair to generalize that a risk-based investment strategy is going to yield less return by its nature in terms of risk avoidance?
That's a great question, because I think the perception is very broad that it does, and that the answer to your question would be yes. And what we've found is that the answer is no. That when you lay it out and you think about a portfolio created and policies created from a risk perspective, you're still trying to meet the obligations of the plan. You're still recognizing the health of the financial sponsor, be it a county or a corporation or what have you. And then you can then make a decision about, well, we actually have some room here, and we want to dial up risk in this case. And here's how we're going to do it. And the end result then is very customized. It can be actually a higher risk allocation. Scott and I were talking earlier about one client that we have. We don't consult to it, but one client that purposefully dialed up risk significantly because of it. And you know, they are now looking at a much higher return. They are facing a much higher risk profile. They run the risk of a significant drawdown. But the financial sponsor looked at it and said, yep, that's exactly what we want, and we understand that. And we have the financial backing, financial health, that if things do go wrong, we can step in and provide the safety net. But in the meantime, we want to engage in a higher risk profile.
Just to add on to that a little bit, if you think about the big difference between a traditional sort of asset-based policy and a risk-based policy, the big difference is one of perspective. And by that, I mean you shift your focus from thinking about return as the primary driver of the investment policy to risk tolerance as the primary driver. And so the things that come in your risk-based investment policy are how much risk do we want to take on? How do we want to measure that risk? Are there ranges or bounds around the authority that we give to staff to move the risk dial? So it's really becomes a risk focus. You could implement your current policy or your current asset allocation through a risk-based policy.
I actually thought we were. See, I maybe I'm looking at it kind of naively, but I thought that the structure of the asset allocation reflects the risk you're willing to take in any given aspect of it. In other words, if you weight to equities, you're taking on more risk, right? You're taking on equity risk anyway,
right?
Versus something else. If you weight to fixed income, you're going with something that's less risky but has less return. So I always thought that the asset allocation was premised, at least in part,
it is
on risk.
Well, so and this we can have a long conversation on this, right? Because it gets sort of philosophical. Are you starting with return or are you starting with risk? I would posit that most institutional investors today start with return. Your primary objective is that actuarial assumed rate of return. That's what most people think about, and the risk is a fallout from that. A risk-based policy starts with enterprise risk tolerance, which we've talked some about, and we'll talk more about when we get together for the investment strategy development workshop. And you say, okay, well, here's what we think we can accommodate in terms of risk, and you can measure that in terms of standard deviation or potential drawdowns or volatility of contributions. And then you say, okay, if that's what we can accommodate in terms of risk, we need an asset allocation or a risk allocation that's going to get us that, and the fallout becomes the return. Now, that's a completely different way of looking at the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would have looked at it the opposite way. I would have thought about the return.
As most do.
You look at what the fund needs, and you've got an aging population, you've got retirees outweighing actives, and you've got, you know, the Social Security flip. You know what your requirement is. You know what your net is you have to make, and you can assume an investment return for purposes of the analysis, so you got to figure out how to make the money.
Right, but then at what risk, right?
And well, so the risk then is an interesting way of being able to think about your asset allocation in terms of your liabilities. So a simplified structure of this would be to think about liability-driven investing that is very popular in the corporate world, where they say we want to fully immunize our portfolio. We want to create a portfolio of bonds that has the same interest rate sensitivity as our liabilities, and we'll fully fund it, match it, and then we don't need to worry so much about the market conditions because ideally they'll move in lockstep. They still have some basis risk, but they'll move in lockstep. Okay, so that's one way. Now, we don't want to do that, but we can think about that liability side and the risks posed and what changes in the market rate sensitivities and create a portfolio, thinking about it, using those metrics. And then, to do that, a risk-based approach can be informative in helping you think through those.
Another sort of intuitive way, just to simplify this, is currently you have an asset allocation and ranges around those asset allocations, right, that you can move within. A risk-based policy, a pure risk-based policy, you'd have a risk allocation and ranges around those risks and moving within those risks. So it's just a perspective shift and a different way to look at it.
You know, it's just interesting to me. We can manipulate certain numbers, though. Maybe manipulate's the wrong word. We can select certain numbers. We can decide what our assumed rate of return is. In fact, we must.
Right.
And we apparently decide CPI is currently 3.5%, which is interesting to me, or 3.25%, whatever it is. But which strikes me as high. So the numbers that we put in those boxes drive a large part of this discussion, it seems to me.
Absolutely.
If we lowered the assumed rate of return from 7.25% to 6.75%, it's going to change that whole analytical scenario, I think.
So, and we're going to have some heavy discussion on this at the investment strategy workshop, but let's just say you guys agree that we should start with risk, because risk is more easily forecasted than return, and you can actually manage to risk better than you can manage return. All those reasons why we like to think about risk sort of at the forefront. Let's just say that you guys made the decision that, and I'm just picking one risk metric, we cannot afford to have risk higher than 8% volatility, standard deviation of 8% volatility. You guys, for whatever reason, come up with that number. Well, that may get you a 5.5% expected return, right? And so you would probably say, well, that is not going to work for us. And so you think of return now as a constraint. Okay, well, maybe this might force us to think outside the box a little bit in terms of asset allocation. Maybe we're willing to think about asset classes that we weren't otherwise willing to think about. Maybe we need to be a little bit more creative in how we construct our asset allocation, because we don't really want to go over that 8% risk, because that's our risk tolerance as we've defined it, but we really can't live with a 5.5% return. So return becomes sort of a constraint that you have to work within that may cause you to think differently or think more creatively. You certainly cannot just discard that actuarial assumed rate of return, and we're not suggesting that you do. But the idea is to start with risk and have return be the constraint, rather than start with return and have risk be just a fallout that we don't even really think too much about.
Scott, if we followed this all the way through to setting on a white piece of paper what our assumption is, I think we would go to 5.5% as our assumed discount rate. Okay, what would that do?
I'm just using sample numbers, right?
I understand. And what that would then do is cause the employer and employees to put more contributions in,
sure,
because there's a lower expectation of return.
Well, they'd pack the room first.
Right.
We call that
implications. But it all falls out that if that's the basis upon which you effectively set your assumption rate, as we assume the risk level that we are willing to accept, and what falls out of that is 5.5. So what do we then do? We adjust our discount rate to 5.5, and we have a combination of return on assets plus contributions equal to our future liabilities. They're obviously a
and frankly, that's the way we argue. That's the way it should have been done way back when, right? But it wasn't, and so we're dealing with practical realities now that we're just trying to optimize.
So we've painted a stark contrast too, and part of the idea that this is evolutionary is that this might be the direction we want to go to over time. That doesn't mean we'd get there tomorrow. So we can think about that as well in terms of setting out the guiding mission, the guiding purpose here. But today's IPS might be a step in that direction, and that's what we work with, and we don't necessarily go from 7.25 down to 5.5, but we think about.
Which actually, interestingly, brings us full circle back to your original question. Does a risk-based approach necessarily lead to lower return expectations? In that scenario that I just painted, it did. But it doesn't have to, right? Your risk tolerance could be a 15% vol, which could get you, 8.5% expected. So it's just you start with risk rather than return.
So in that scenario, the risk tolerance that we identify and then quantify in some means, mm-hmm, is sort of the rough equivalent of the flip side of us selecting an assumed rate of return. In other words, that number becomes the driver in how you do a risk-based analysis.
Yeah, and I don't want to say driver, because it still remains critically important. That assumed rate of return remains a very important constraint, right? So it's driver, we can quibble over word choice, but but it's just the starting point of a discussion rather than a driveway.
Well, I'm just saying that if you had, you know, a low risk tolerance, but you have a system that is historically accustomed to 7.5, 7.25, and then the outcome of the lower risk tolerance is we're at 5.5%. I mean, I would be a flip earlier, but you know, that's a yeah. huge issue for employers and employees.
Absolutely.
It's just, that's the practicality of that decision, right? So I'm just trying to understand, well, if does it mean then there's the potential to, hate to use the word manipulate, but to select a higher risk tolerance to sort of avoid that result?
Well, absolutely there is, right? But let's do it with full information, and the full information that you guys are going to have when we do the asset liability study and get together for the investment strategy development workshop is, you know, you'll see what that does to contributions. You'll see what it does to expected funded ratios. And so you'll have good information to make those judgments.
I mean, let's look at the other side of the scenario as well. The historical model where your asset mix is driven by your actuarial assumed rate leads you to be somewhat ignorant of risk. As you say, the risk is the fallout. So if we're in an expensive market environment, return expectations are reduced, and we're still trying to hit a legacy actuarial rate of return, it's causing you to ramp up your risk profile. Now, what's the potential downside there? The potential downside there is you're buying riskier assets when they're expensive. If there's a downdraft, the UAAL gets inflated. You have the bigger holdbacks there. And so you can say it's more expensive in current terms, but that expense is going to be built into the system at one point in time. If you're accepting greater variability and possible outcomes, you're going to have periods where your assets decline far below your liability stream. And that's got to be made up as well. But there is absolutely a balancing act. And I think the team of Aris is doing is saying, let's have a more holistic approach of all the drivers, current contribution, expected downside scenarios, and through the risk lens, you can kind of pull together all those and start to make trade-offs.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to take you into the weeds of what you want to do at the end.
The weeds are what we like to
do. I'm just trying to understand the concept.
Yeah, thank you.
And to follow on to Tim's comment, I think it might be good, since this is a newer approach, as you mentioned, and a number of our peers aren't really looking at changing to possibly this approach, I think it might be useful to kind of talk to the board about why we're, you know, bringing this to them to consider at this time. And, you know, Tim talked a little bit about some of the benefits, but since this is kind of a beginning discussion, it's definitely not ending today, but it's a beginning discussion, I think it's important that they understand why we're looking at possibly shifting or wanting to take the focus in another direction than just merely the asset allocation approach.
Yeah. So, great question. There are lots of components to that. So, part of it is the technology, our ability to see these things, our ability to calculate these and run these things. We've talked a lot about using MSCI Borrow One tool. That gives us a view into these things. That is fairly new and something that can be applied here. So, part of it is technology and the advancement there. Part of it is where we stand today. Back to Tim's point, we are in a lower return environment today. And you've heard everyone say this, right? All of the fixed income managers are saying this. It's a topic at every conference you attend anymore, I think. And that low interest rate environment is really interesting because when you look at it over time, the obligation, the challenge put before a pension board has evolved. And the ability to hit a target return rate, a 7.25% return, was largely driven by a cash rate that might have been 3% or 4%. And so how much extra risk did you have to take with the portfolio to get that 7.25%? Not that much. Pretty reasonable amount. As that cash rate has come down and the rate of returns across all asset classes have come down as well, to get to that 7.25%, you're taking on much more risk today than you were back then. So now it becomes, it's sort of that risk wasn't at the center of the discussion because it didn't need to be. Now it needs to be, and we need to be thinking more critically about that. And so that's another key piece. Scott had mentioned a portion earlier about risks are easier to predict and more stable than returns. That's a tough one to digest, right? I mean, academically, you'd want to say, prove that to me. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So when you think about what that means, though, it means that the volatility of returns is pretty high. You don't know what you're going to get. And if you take a look at one of those periodic table of asset class returns, it's all over the place. It keeps us all humble. The volatility, though, does stay pretty consistent. When you take something like 2008, global financial crisis, yep, that's a one-off. Things did not behave as you'd expect. When you take 1929, yep, that's a one-off. Things did not behave as you'd expect. Throughout most of the rest of the cycles, though, not such a big surprise. The volatilities are actually there. And so when you construct a portfolio with those kind of volatilities, you know what you're going to get through most cycles. You're going to have a 2008 every once in a while that's going to throw you off, and you have to think about, how do we protect against that? What's the real downside? What's the health of the financial sponsor? That gets into the enterprise risk tolerance component as sort of a guardrail, making sure we don't want the pension plan to bring down the rest of the county. So how do we just sort of manage within that? And we can think about those components. So those are a couple off the cuff thoughts. I think there are probably
more to follow. Thanks. Good stuff.
I thought you were going to go much longer.
No.
Okay. Carry on. Let's turn to page 8. Page 8 highlights one interesting thing within the investment policy that you have today, and that's really the beginnings of a liquidity management process. And we think this is very smart to have, because liquidity, cash coming into, cash coming out of the plan is key, and you've already thought through how it can be dealt with. Probably some refinements can be made to it, but definitely a nice component to have built in. The potential improvements on page 9, there are a couple here, and there are a number that I could talk to as well. And so this is where I think we can also have an interesting discussion, because today, when you look at the investment policy statement, if any of you were coming to the board today, fresh, hadn't seen or knew anything about Contra Costa County Employees Retirement Association, said, oh, great, sit down with the IPS and read it, what would you come away with? And on one hand, you'd come away with a pretty good understanding of what's going on. In another respect, you'd look at it and say, yeah, I have all these pieces that are kind of operational in nature that deal with some specific components, but what's really the philosophy? What's really the beliefs about the committee in general and their approach to investing the assets and meeting the liabilities? And that part isn't really in there. And you can almost assume it, and it's kind of rooted back to that history, that the way portfolios have been constructed, the way pension plans have operated, everyone knows that. It's kind of a shared understanding. Today it's a little different, though. And as we're starting to see investment policy statements from others that we're consulting to, others that are viewed as thought leaders in the industry, they're starting to put more work into the beliefs. What do we believe about the markets? What's our philosophy? What do I mean by that? As an example, you might think about the role of active versus passive. And active versus passive can get into specifics. We should index this strategy. We should not index this strategy. But it's also a more general approach into, do we believe the markets are efficient? If so, how efficient? If we think they're broadly efficient, but we know that there are pockets of opportunities there, maybe we should say that. And if we believe that to be the truth, then we would say, well, where we think there's efficiency and you can't really gain much from active management, we should probably look for indexing opportunities. Let's save the costs. If you say, no, we think that they're only semi-efficient, that you can actually find managers across almost all asset classes who can outperform, who can earn their keep, who can pay for their own fees, then we should have that. That's one example of something that we might have as a philosophy. Something else we might think about in terms of market dislocations. What was 2008? Is that a one-off? Is that something we should be thinking about and prepared for? And if so, what do we do to it? How do we respond in that environment? We could think about approaches to managing real downside risk. When we talk about real downside risk, we're talking about the tail risk, those kinds of events that are down 25% kind of years. What would we do in that situation? What opportunities would that present to us? 2009 was a great time to invest in U.S. equities, great time to invest in fixed income, great time to invest in real estate, great time to invest in pretty much everything aside from cash. And so what do we do? Are we prepared to have that cash ready to deploy? How fast can we respond to that? So we can have philosophies and beliefs incorporated, attitudes. Along with those same kinds of things, then, as you create that beliefs and you create that philosophy, then you think about how should it be implemented. And you start thinking more about who does what. What are the roles, the responsibilities, the accountabilities? And let's articulate those. Let's get those spelled out into what does the board do? And what are the boundaries around the board? And where does that cut off? And where does staff kick in? Where does the consultant kick in? Where do custodian responsibilities? What are delegated to the investment managers? And think about how all those pieces come together. So that's something else I think we can look towards doing. And then when you put those pieces in place, roles and responsibilities, who does what? What controls do we put around this? What metrics do we put around this? So we know when they're operating within tolerable bands and when another party has to step in as an oversight. So fine, there are small things that your investment consultant can do, that your staff can do, that would fall under more administrivia than actual board needs. So let's delegate that appropriately, but let's put the oversight function in there so that you can appropriately verify it. Trust and verify, right? So you can verify that what's being done makes sense and that it comes back to you. Let me pause there. I said a lot of things.
It must have been perfect, Ed. There were no questions.
Well, so those are, again, some of the things we want to key up for the ISD, Investment Strategy Development Workshop. We have some interesting things in here as well. You work within CERL, right? And it's not actually referenced as the guiding regulation within the IPS. It's probably something we could do. We could probably put in a scope within the IPS and understand how this fits into the regulatory environment. Just kind of a standard best practice, nothing particularly exciting about that. We have some significant language devoted to manager selection, due diligence, monitoring. One idea we could do, we could kick around, is whether we want to have the manager selection as a separate document that is referenced within the IPS. The reason you might want to consider doing that is because if there's an investment manager who wants to work with you, you hand it to them. Here are requirements. They don't have to read through the whole IPS. It's kind of a nice game plan for them. It also simplifies what you do, and then that document can get more detailed into the specifics of investment managers by asset classes or types, illiquid, liquid kind of profiles. You can think about different things like that, and you can contemplate developing that document as a separate piece.
And we now just give the managers, when we are getting an RFP, the copy of the policy, the whole thing?
Yes.
That's what we now do. And what you're describing is that we would do, have an abbreviated one, just dealing with what we are looking to them for.
Okay. Much more focused.
Okay. More focused, yeah.
Is that the norm, by the way? I mean, is your experience, is that what, in general, other plans do?
So the manager selection process, I guess, as a norm, is less detailed in what I typically see than what you currently have. So the idea, I guess, is that I like what you have and want to keep it, but because it feels more operational and customized to the investment managers, pulling it out makes the investment policy statement a cleaner document. So I guess that's how I position it. Do you have a different take?
No.
Is the normal way in which we would deal with some of these changes to agendize it for a future meeting? Is that mechanically?
Yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the timeline would be coming out of the ISD workshop, we would have an investment policy statement drafted post that meeting based upon the feedback from the board at that offsite.
Yeah, so, and this is spelled out in the work plan that we presented to you at the beginning of our engagement. We want to get through the investment strategy development workshop and come out of there with a number of decisions. Those decisions will inform what the investment policy statement looks like. We will work with staff to put together a draft investment policy statement for your review at that point.
Is the ISDW a copyrighted?
Not yet.
It's too hard to say.
Because you've been saying it so many times.
ISD workshop.
You're trying to
trying to drill it into your brain.
Exactly.
Put a little R above it.
ISDW, yeah.
We're big fans of TLAs.
This one's a FLA.
T- three-letter acronym.
Yeah,
four-letter acronym, right. So that's really it. We wanted to tee these things up as some things to get you thinking about. I don't know if you've had a chance to read your investment policy statement lately. It's probably something that you have filed in somewhere. It's provided as an appendix here. I'm sorry?
It's on the CICERA website.
It's on the CICERA website. It's provided as an appendix in here, too. So if you haven't had a chance, maybe some of these thoughts start germinating some ideas that will come out later. And as you think about what is actually done here as a committee, what should be done, and how do we want to appropriately document that, hopefully we've laid some groundwork for those.
Yeah, and all of this is teeing you up with concepts and introducing you to ideas that for that ISD workshop that we're going to schedule.
Was that again?
Momentarily.
Copyright pending.
Trademark pending.
Circle R.
Operational to aspirational. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Operational to aspirational. I like that.
Turn of phrase there.
Trademark.
So also, I guess, part of this exercise in having a current assessment is to understand any and all issues, that we have collectively a shared understanding of where we are today so that we are heading in the right direction together. So, part of it, and I think some of this came out through the interviews as well, we asked if there are any sacred cows or anything we should know about. And I don't think we found anything particularly sacred.
Yeah, I'm sure they just didn't share them with us.
They didn't share them with us.
We could have told
we'll
you.
We'll let you touch that third rail and then.
Anything else on the current state assessment?
Sounds like
you.
Thank you for the presentation. Meeting schedule